I want to tell you about a podcast you should check out. It's called Understood Explains. This season of the show is hosted by teacher and special education expert Juliana Urtube, and it's all about how to navigate individual education plans, also known as IEPs. The latest season of Understood Explains covers topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP, and it busts common myths about special education. As a parent myself of a child who's had an IEP since kindergarten, and he's now a 10th grader, I know how confusing, overwhelming, frustrating, sometimes daunting the whole process can be. I checked out an episode of Understood Explains called The Difference Between IEPs and 504 Plans. And what I love about it is how easily Juliana explains everything. She answers common questions that probably every parent or caregiver has. She dispels myths and is concise and to the point. To listen to Understood Explains, search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. And there's a direct link in the show notes if you need it.
Is my partner narcissistic? And I'm thinking, you're asking the wrong question. You've really got to stay focused on these behaviors, because if these behaviors are consistently showing up, it doesn't matter what they are. Ultimately, these behaviors are what's going to harm you. And their personality is a statement on the fact that these behaviors are going to remain consistent.
You're listening to Make Some Noise Podcast, episode number 585 with Dr. Ramani Durvasala. Welcome to Make Some Noise Podcast, your guide for strategies, tools, and insight to empower yourself. I'm your host, Andrea Owen, global speaker, entrepreneur, life coach since 2007, and author of 3 books that have been translated into 18 languages and are available in 22 countries. Each week, I'll bring you a guest or a lesson that will help you maximize unshakable confidence, master resilience, and make some noise in your life. You ready? Let's go. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm so glad that you're here. I'm really excited about today's guest because every time I have someone that comes on who talks about healing from a narcissistic relationship, I get a lot of downloads. I tend to get a lot of people who are interested in this, and our guest today is an expert on it. She has a huge social media platform where she talks about this topic a lot. She's written a couple books, and we're going to get into it in just a second. But first, I wanted to make sure that I tell you that I am going to start a weekly live stream. I'm really excited about this. I haven't done it in what feels like 150 years. I'm going to be going live on Facebook, on my Facebook page, which is Your Kickass Life. My Instagram page, I'm at Hey Andrea Owen over there. And if you are a personal Facebook friend of mine, I'll be live over there. It starts on March 6th, 2024, if you're listening to this into the future. And it's going to be Wednesdays at noon Eastern time, 9 Pacific. I'm also going to be live on TikTok as well. I forgot about that. All at the same time. Wish me luck, you guys, with this technology. I'm hoping it all goes just smoothly. And each week is going to have a topic. It might correspond with either a guest that I had on or a mini-sode that I did where I can, you know, I'm just going to expand on it. I'm going to take your questions. I can even have some of you come onto the live with me and maybe I can do some laser coaching. I don't know. It's just going to kind of happen as it happens. And I'm really excited about it. Another way to serve you and just really connect with you guys. I've been missing you. Have you been missing me? All right. Let me tell you about, oh, and one more thing. I have a couple openings. I think I might have 2 openings for coaching right now. So head on over to andreaowen.com/coaching and you can read about the kind of client that I work with, see if it's a match for you. And there's an application right there. Okay. So coaching and live stream starting March 6th. Let me tell you a little bit about today's guest. Dr. Ramani Durvasala is a licensed clinical psychologist in Los Angeles, California. Her academic research was focused on the impact of personality and personality disorders on health and behavior. She's the author of multiple books, including Should I Stay or Should I Go? Surviving a Relationship with a Narcissist and Don't You Know Who I Am? How to Stay Sane in an Era of Narcissism, Entitlement, and Incivility, and her newest book, It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People. So without further ado, here is Dr. Ramani. Dr. Ramani, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm excited. Well, I'm always excited when someone has a new book coming out because I know it feels like a baby a little bit.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And we are in the last trimester here. So, yeah.
We're in the last trimester.
Yeah.
All right. And I have had people come on and talk about relationships. And I've had a couple people we've touched on how to heal from narcissistic relationships or abuse. Like, you know, sort of what is that? But it's been a minute. So, can we start? I would like to start kind of in the beginning. And can you let us know, like, what are the behaviors that you see the most often that are harmful in relationships, whether the person perpetuating them, like, let's start from the very beginning, whether the person perpetuating them is a bona fide narcissist or not?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm even going to go one step beyond your question, which is, in a way, it doesn't matter what the person's personality is, right? Mm-hmm. So I've always pushed that point because I think there's so much confusion that people are sitting there and analyzing at a granular level, is my partner narcissistic? And I'm thinking, you're asking the wrong question. You've really got to stay focused on these behaviors, because if these behaviors are consistently showing up, it doesn't matter what they are. Ultimately, these behaviors are what's going to harm you. And their personality is a statement on the fact that these behaviors are going to remain consistent. So personality in some ways is a context that tells you that it's always going to be here. It's like somebody built a house on a toxic dump site. You're always going to get sick living there. It doesn't matter what that house looks like. So there's a stability to it. The behaviors that are so problematic in any relationship, frankly, are doubting the reality and the feelings of the other person, creating a space where it's not safe for the other person to express needs and feelings. And that's done by shutting them down, basically invalidating those feelings, being dismissive of them, minimizing them, rage and anger being a central core kind of communication style in the relationship, typically when the other person isn't getting their way, because that will often shut the other person in the relationship down. So the antagonistic person in the relationship always has that kind of in their back pocket. If I don't like what's happening, I'm going to start raging. And if the other person is afraid of rage, which is the vast majority of people, right, they will be able to emotionally continue to abuse them. And so it's these kinds of behaviors where there's a tremendous power asymmetry. Anything that drives an asymmetry in power leaves one person in the relationship constantly feeling on their back foot. And these tactics, especially gaslighting, leave the person who actually isn't behaving badly wondering if it's them who's mm-hmm. behaving badly. And remember, too, that it's not a one-day thing. It's not just happening on the day one of the people in the relationship loses their job, okay? So that's a day they're not graceful, and they're snappy, and they're angry. And then by the end of that day, they say, I'm so sorry. I had no right to behave like that. You've been nothing but supportive. If there's a quick making of amends, yeah, while that day may have been unpleasant, and that person needs to get it together and not do that again, that's not a narcissistic relationship. That's a bad day. And I think, and even, you know, listen, many narcissistic people are unfaithful in relationship, or they engage in other kinds of betrayal behaviors. They're financially betraying. They're sort of slippery with the truth kind of thing, right? And so what happens then is that a lot of people say, my partner cheated on me. He's narcissistic. I'll be like, slow down. Let's take this backwards. He cheated on you, and that was a terrible thing to do. But the context may not support narcissism. So I think that the idea is that to really get focused on what are unacceptable behaviors in a relationship, recognize them as unacceptable, not justify them, and make your decisions accordingly. The more these behaviors are consistent and stable and happen on many, many days, and that even if there's good periods in between, that ups the likelihood that this is a narcissistic person. So I think people are kind of barking up the wrong tree. They keep sort of saying, okay, entitled, arrogant, right, grandiose. They're going down the list. And because those things aren't as obvious as you would think, A vulnerable narcissistic person's grandiosity won't look the same way as a malignant person's or a grandiose person's. It looks different. So if you go by that, you're not trying to diagnose this person. You're looking for patterns that are unhealthy. The reason for the conversation about narcissism is to really put a finer point on how stable this is going to be. Because a lot of the whole relationship literature is, this can change. There's a way you can talk to this person. There's something that can be done. If narcissism's in the house, really there's not. So either you're going to adjust to the weather or you're going to be cold.
I love that we started here because I have sort of seen, and I'm sure that you have too, that this has become a buzzword lately. It's mm-hmm. been, the vernacular has been used so much more in even just, you know, like pop culture. So, and I wonder if people are using, you know, the average person trying to diagnose their partner and using that as an excuse to stay. So it's like, well, they don't check off this box, so they're not a narcissist, so maybe I can change this person. When all of their behaviors are pretty terrible and that the person should leave. Do you see this in your practice or in your work?
I see it in my work, right? Because, I mean, I think, listen, people use the buzzword because it's going to get eyes on them. It doesn't mean that they know how to use it correctly. And that's a real problem with this word because this is a heavy, big, personally, I think, wonderful word in the sense of it is so descriptive. But it's also very nuanced. And it's interesting. You're bringing up the B side of a record because the A side is usually, I need this person to be narcissistic. I know they're narcissistic. And I'm thinking, wrong conversation. But the other side you're saying is they're not ticking enough boxes. So maybe I should stay. I have had that happen. Absolutely. Especially in clinical practice. And the conversation we have is then, I will then say to them, we don't even need to use this word. I see that these patterns are stable. And the one thing we know about human behavior is that it is stable. It is our past behavior tends to predict our future behavior unless something pretty cataclysmic happened in the middle. Things like trauma can certainly change a behavioral track or a head injury or something like mm-hmm. that. But beyond that, we tend to be relatively consistent beings. Why? Because of that personality again. So when somebody says to me, I don't know, maybe they're not narcissistic, I'm going to stick it out. First of all, I have no agenda for someone. If you want to stay in this relationship, you stay in this relationship. There's a lot of reasons people stay. Mm-hmm. But my response to that is, and what you're staying in is always going to be like this. Yeah. So we're going to have to create workarounds for this. And that's usually the light bulb moment for them. They're like, oh, okay, well, no. But I thought they were not. I said, it doesn't matter if they're narcissistic. I said, these behaviors are not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's, again, I'm using the example of climate because I think it fits here, right? A place that's cold is cold. So a person says, hey, I want to move to Chicago, but I really want an outdoor swimming pool 12 months of the year, and I hate wearing coats. And I'm thinking, you know, this isn't going to work. So you move there and you try to live like that, you're going to freeze to death.
Yeah, great analogy. Well, it's interesting because I'm of course, thinking about my own life. And I was in a long relationship from my late teens until I was 31. And that relationship, whether he was a narcissist or not, a lot of those behaviors, betrayal, lying, so much gaslighting. And this was in years before we even knew, like I knew what that word was. And it wasn't until years later where people were using it. I was like, oh my God, that's what was happening to me. I thought I was losing my mind. I was being told I was crazy for even thinking he would cheat on me. Meanwhile, he was like living a double life and having an affair. And so what I learned was in that relationship is, and it might've been a chicken or egg situation. We both grew up and learned behaviors that weren't great. But I learned how to manipulate. I learned how to engage in these behaviors in the relationship that were really gross to me, even when I was participating in them. And then when I got out and I got remarried and I got sober and I started doing this work and I really started listening to my personal therapist and marriage counselors and learned how to, like you said, repair when I have screwed up to... when I think about manipulating to try to get my way or because I'm scared to not do that.
Right.
So I just want to say, like, I think people do change. They mature and evolve. Do you think that, you know, there are certain people where, I don't know if this is a great question or not, but I'm like, I'm almost like over here defending myself. Cause if someone looked at me when I was 25, they would have been like, she's kind of a narcissist. And I'd be like, you're not wrong. Like,
Okay, but let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question. Though. You said something really important. You said you still weren't sober, right?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
And I even if I wasn't drinking a lot, I had like that alcoholic.
Okay, so let's break that down for a minute because addiction and alcoholism and substance use muddy the waters quite a bit. I don't know how familiar you are with 12-step terminology and all of that,
very familiar.
Okay. So you're very familiar with the concept of the dry drunk, right?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. The dry drunk is just a narcissist. Right. So the big book, all of 12 step, if you read it front to back, it is probably one of the best manuals out there on a person confronting their own narcissism. So part of the problem with sobriety management, relapse management, recovery in the long term is, especially if you look at it from a quantitative perspective, we measure it as, is a person no longer drinking or using? That's half the journey.
Oh,
it's
sure.
like getting up to the top of a mountain and saying, I'm done. I'm like, no. We got to get back down off of here. And that back down is to address all the stuff, right? All the stuff, the manipulation, the lying, the denial, the harm of others, the not taking accountability, the lack of taking responsibility. Step six, character defects. It's all there. So if you look at it that way, a lot of folks who have gone through recovery don't bother with that piece. We have a lot of dry drunks walking out there. So one of the things I assess early in the game is, does this person have a history of addiction? Because I'm going to be coming at this from a different angle. We still search for what is the right treatment model for narcissism. I'm going to be frank with you. 12-step may be as good a model as we've got because there's this chronic going back into this need for showing up as a humble person. Mm-hmm. But without the buy-in of sobriety, without that sort of behavioral buy-in, it's a little tougher. And against the backdrop of the disease of addiction. So I think that what I would argue, and I'm going to actually double down on my assertion that no, these patterns don't change, is that what was talking in your 20s was an addict, not a narcissist. Mm-hmm. And when your addiction got resolved and you committed to recovery, what happened was those proverbial dry drunk patterns lifted. The step six got worked through. Yeah. You made the proper amends. You kept that integrated and that sustained. Had you not been drinking, had you been a fully not using, not drinking, sober person and behaving like that, I don't think we would be talking about your change right now.
Yep. I don't think I would be talking to anybody about change.
Mm-hmm.
Let alone experts like you. I appreciate that so much. And I found myself getting emotional when you said that because partly just validation of what I have said over and over again here on this show is even if someone has struggled with any kind of substance, I always say sobriety and recovery are two very different things.
Yes, they are. Very different. Yeah.
Very different. Getting sober for me was the easy part, like just quitting drinking. And that wasn't even easy, but it was easier to me than, like you were saying, coming back down the mountain, like the actual work involved, the amends making, the noticing when I'm behaving in ways that I don't want to, stopping myself before I'm about to bite back at someone who's bit me and understanding like, that's not how I want to show up. I'm going to end up apologizing for this if I say it.
Right. So then let's throw something else in there, right? Because we've talked about addiction. Then there's the piece, like you said, I want to bite back when someone bites at me. Part of this also becomes trauma response. And this is where the water gets even more muddy. You know, there's big T and there's small T trauma, you know, and obviously a lot of the betrayal relational trauma is on a continuum. For some people, what happened during childhood was a day after day after day of being unseen, unheard, manipulation. And for other people, it was, you know, we'd consider physical and sexual violence and abuse. Obviously, we don't compare traumas, we don't compare pains, but we're going to see different impacts. However, the way we show up in relationships is often a safety response, right? We're trying to seek safety or we're trying to seek attachment. And ideally, those two go together. So the biting back is often a way of seeking safety. Now, the same argument, however, could be made for the narcissistic person. And a lot of people make that argument that narcissism may, in fact, be in part a trauma response. I get that. I would say 25% of my practice for a long time was narcissistic clients. Some with histories of trauma, some with histories of addiction, some with neither. And so when they had neither, they were the hardest clients to treat. When they had these other stories, we had other places to get in there, other things to focus on. However, you still got to show up. You got to do the work. And what happens is the other people around the narcissistic person are saying, I see that, like you just said, I bite back or I withdraw. Many, many more people who go through narcissistic abuse are overregulated and they withdraw. They're afraid. They are, they don't, they start believing what's said to them. And that's the insidiousness of narcissistic abuse. It's not just the day in and day out enduring the nonsense. It's the internalization that I'm a bad person. And the healing is, no, you're not a bad person. A person was telling you you're a bad person, and we got to stop listening to them. That's, and you, whether you stop listening to them by ending the relationship or disengaging from it, that's a different conversation. But I do think we have to account for, how do people stay safe in relationships? And a lot of what happens in a narcissistic relationship is this really toxic dance of the narcissistic person having one motivation and one motivation only, which is power, dominance, and control. That's what they want. That's what a relationship is to them. The other person may want attachment, connection, and safety. Those is one person's playing chess, one person's playing checkers. It doesn't work. Same board, different games.
Yeah. Okay, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you about trauma bonding. We'll be right back. There's definitely been times in my life where my paycheck ran out before I got paid again, and I wish I could have accessed my next paycheck a few days before I was due to get it. Well, what if I told you that can happen with Earnin? Earnin is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. Just download the Earnin app and verify your paycheck. Then access up to $100 a day as you work and leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. You can use Earnin for anything you need to, therapy visits, rent, or even extra self-help books. Make Earnin a part of your financial routine and join Earnin's over 3.5 million customers who say things like, "When I think about Earnin, I think about financial stability and security. It gives me a lot of peace of mind." Download Earnin today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in Noise under podcast when you sign up. It really helps the show. Noise under podcast. Subject to your available earnings, location, daily max, and pay period max. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Are you overwhelmed by the things that get in the way of you doing what you want to do? Are you looking for ways to simplify life to better align with your values? Do you want to create space in your schedule so you have room for more of the good stuff? Play, joy, relationships, gratitude, and more? If you answered yes to any of these questions, I invite you to check out Edit Your Life, a podcast to help you edit the unnecessary from your life so you have more room to enjoy the awesome. Through episodes with me, Christine Coe, and a range of super smart, compassionate, and thoughtful guests, you'll come away with big picture insights and practical ways to declutter your home, schedule, and mental space without getting bogged down by perfection. I have always believed that small moments and actions matter tremendously. My goal is to help you find agency and space in your life through doable baby steps that will leave you feeling accomplished instead of overwhelmed. Check out Edit Your Life wherever you enjoy your podcasts.
All right, we're back. Dr. Romani's book is called, new book, you have several, it's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People. Can we talk about trauma bonding? Mm-hmm. How does someone know that they're experiencing that?
One of the ways, couple of tells, you know, I mean, it's a complicated dynamic, but a couple of the tells are things like you're constantly justifying. And because you're constantly justifying and people don't want to hear it anymore, you might even start kind of telling, sort of portraying your relationship as better than it is, right? So you can kind of keep it located in a better place, even though, you know, if you shared the real truth, people would say, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. People who are trauma bonded keep having the same arguments over and over again. They believe the false promises that the narcissistic person makes. You know, one thing that often tells me that person's in a trauma bonded relationship, it's sort of like therapist hack. When a person is describing really, really dysfunctional patterns in a relationship to me over and over again, but can't get out and claim that, I really, really love them. I do. I really love them. I'll say, okay, no, I'm never the one to sit here and doubt anyone's love's a very subjective experience. Can you tell me why you love them? And when a person's trauma bonded, invariably their answer is, okay, wait, give me a second. It's like this, I can't really describe, I don't know, there's no words. Like I just sort of like have, it's this, I don't know, it's like this feeling. It's like, I don't know, it's like this connection. That's not an answer. Mm-hmm. If you ask a healthy person that question, they'll say, you know, we get each other. We have you know, we have similar interests, shared values. They believe in me. It's the answers are much more healthy, collaborative. They make sense. The person who's trauma bonded actually cannot pull out anything but the most ephemeral, magical reason for it. Then when we're looking at people who are trauma bonded, another big tell is when a person who's trauma bonded even does visualization about the relationship ending or getting out of it, they'll literally say, I feel a sense of panic.
Yeah.
You know, when it really comes to go time, that this is, they've had the 150th argument about the same thing, one more episode of gaslighting and on and on and on. Like, I got to get out of this. Or they uncover one more lie or whatever it is. When the moment comes, they're like, I'm going to get together with them Friday. I'm going to tell them this is done. They'll say, I literally feel like all the oxygen is being pulled out of my lungs. There's a physiological response. And trauma is a physiological phenomenon. So none of that is any wonder. And I think that the challenge with the trauma bond is, in some ways, it's more comfortable to stay in the harmful relationship than it is to navigate the unknown territory of getting out, because it's like you're inviting a panic attack, which is really not what anyone wants to do.
No.
And in the weeks, the days, the weeks, and the months after a person ends a toxic, narcissistic, antagonistic, call it whatever you want, relationship, they will say, I was bumping into walls. I thought it was going to be easier. And they'll say, interestingly, in the day-to-day, it kind of was, because I wasn't having to listen to them. Again, in these relationships, breakups are tough because the narcissistic person tends to be quite antagonistic even after mm-hmm. the person goes. But even taking that out, they'll say it wasn't sort of a magic pill until it was. And they'll say, this is my nervous system slowly returned to baseline. But it is, because it's so visceral, people find it hard to leave these relationships. And trauma bonds are created. Trauma bond is, I mean, there's a lot of people, again, just like narcissism is misused, gaslighting is misused, trauma bonding is misused as a word. Trauma bonding is not the relationship between two people who have been through trauma. I want to clear that up right away. Mm-hmm. A trauma bond is a bond that feels incredibly intense. That, like I said, almost like these people say magical, but this intense connection created by the alternation of good and bad in a relationship. So it's the good days are exciting. It might be good sex. It might be big laughter. It might be a great Saturday night. And the bad days are that chronic death by a thousand cuts. It's the invalidation, the minimization, the walking on eggshells, that you have to do it just right for them. And so you're constantly going between these two poles. During the bad times, people use the good times to justify it. The problem is the bad times are so unhealthy, because people say, well, isn't that any relationship, good and bad? No. I mean, in any relationship, you might be arguing about a dishwasher, but a person isn't eviscerating you as a human being and telling you you shouldn't be alive or saying something horrible to you mm-hmm. because you say something like that. It's not that. It's the person saying, oh, you didn't empty the dishwasher again. And the other person saying, I know, I forgot. It's that's sort of like within the realm of normal. This is the oppositionality becomes aggressive and rageful, and people feel unheard and unsafe. It's very different dynamic, and it is pretty consistent in all narcissistic relationships because they're so unhealthy. If there was no trauma bond, most of these relationships wouldn't last.
It made my stomach hurt because I was thinking about my former relationship, and the more I learn about this, the more it's clear that there was trauma bonding taking place. And the way I describe it is what you were saying about, you know, the ups and downs mm-hmm, is that mm-hmm. I felt like I would get, you know, put on a rainbow and just, you know, like flying high mm-hmm. and then getting slammed down back onto earth over and over and over again. And the thing that was also interesting about that is that I trusted that cycle more than I trusted my own instincts.
I think that's so well put. So the kind of rainbow and slam down. Rebecca Humphreys is somebody who, she's an actor in the UK. She had written a book and about being gaslighted in the public eye, like in a very public kind of a scandal. And she put it so beautifully. She said, he would push me off the top of a 100-story building and catch me just as I passed the first story and was about to hit the ground. Like, it was the most beautiful, eloquent characterization of this, is that's the dynamic. And what they do in a trauma bonded relationship is, it's often a relationship where that person both breaks you down and puts you back together.
Yeah.
And that really creates an incredibly unbreakable bond. That sort of break you down, put you back together dynamic is something we tend to see in more severe relationships. The vast majority of people in narcissistic relationships, it's not as severe. It's sort of, again, this daily indignity of these relationships. And so, and it's not even so severe that other people notice it, right? It's not someone screaming at you in the middle of dinner. In fact, not narcissistic people are often really, really good at having a great public face mm-hmm. and a really awful in the car. Like the narcissistic abuse, I think probably so much of it happens in a car where no one else is around. You can't
memories.
Get out. Mm-hmm. You can't run away. All of that. So that's the public-private disconnect, too, is that the good mask is on for other people. So other people are telling the person, wow, you're so lucky, or you have such a nice relationship, and the person's dying inside, mm-hmm. and but yet they don't feel ready to out how dysfunctional right. the relationship is, or they feel loyal to it. And you can't underestimate the power of loyalty, because we feel loyal to the people we love, whether they're family or friends or partners. And that loyalty means that a lot of people, I always call it an iceberg, they suffer for years. And by the time they start talking, I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, how long has this been happening?
Yeah. And thank you for that. And I think it, you know, it creates a power dynamic as well. And I was loyal not only to him, but I was loyal to that cycle. And like, I can't emphasize enough, like how much I trusted that cycle. And it was as if my body and my brain, no matter how bad it got, when we were in one of those lows, like, you know, if I'm falling from the building, I trusted without a shred of doubt mm-hmm. that catch, that high that was about to come was better than any drink or drug I could ever take. That's what's frightening to me about our propensity as humans to get caught up in those types of relationships. And so, you know, my heart goes out to anyone who's in it or who's been in it, which brings me to, like, I want to ask you, because in my experience, you know, this person and I broke up 17 years ago, and I recently received some correspondence from this person, and I had a visceral reaction when I saw the name. And, you know, of course, I have the reaction. Then my next thought was like, that's interesting that my body still, you know, it was like the pit of my stomach, just like a full physiological reaction. And someone might say, because when I've talked about it online on social media, people are like, how are you not over this by now? Like how many years ago and you're still talking about it? And I do feel like a little wash of shame when I get those comments. But at the same time, I'm like, I know I'm not the only one who still struggles with the visceral feelings of it and the thoughts that come up. So how does one, I mean, I'm sure no contact is a big help, mm-hmm. but can you talk about sort of the aftermath? Is like when someone does walk away from one of these relationships, like what can they expect and what's helpful for them? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I want to say something about no contact. It's, you know, no contact is funny, right? There's no contact and there's no contact. And what I mean by that is, it's what we were talking about before, even with sobriety, right? There's the person who stops drinking, but is still behaving in all of those, if you will, those ways. There's people who go no contact, but they are still in it in their head, right? The trauma bonded, that, as you call it, the visceral experience isn't done for them. And then there are actually people who didn't go no contact, but they've done the work. Right? They're very aware of how this is being held in their body. They know how to ground themselves. They have realistic expectations, radical acceptance. It's not to say that hurtful words won't still hurt them. Obviously they do. We still have that, but it's not under their skin, if you will, in the same way. All of that said, you know, it so saddens me to hear that somebody would shame you for saying, you know, that saying, I still have this feeling, and they tell you you're not
the
over
internet,
it.
You know,
the internet. I mean, the internet is a narcissist. If the internet was a person, it would be a narcissist. And so, I would hazard to guess you are over it. And I think a lot of people get confused about that physiological response. Remember what we've learned about trauma when we look at Judith Herman's and Bessel van der Kolk's and Janina Fisher's work. It's implicitly held. It's held. It's not held in our talky-talky part, right? It's held in our feely-feely part. Yeah. And as a result, you don't look at that email and say, I can't believe, and you don't articulate a thought. You feel something in your stomach. And you share, and when you share that with the world, they don't get that. But I mean, anyone who's been through trauma or a narcissistic relationship would fully get that. there was a point in time where this relationship represented, like you said, not only the sort of rainbow highway that sort of that sort of ended in a gravel road, but also it was not a safe place.
Right.
And as much as your mind engaged in the rationalizations, no, this is great. This is good. We're good. It's great. I'm rationalized, justify. Your body held it as unsafe. Mm-hmm. So when the memory comes back or the contact comes back, your mind is like, ugh, I'm glad that's over. Mm-hmm. But your body is like, unsafe. And there's this alarm ringing, right? And that's the sign. Your body is telling you something that your mind sort of figured out in a very different way. In a way, this is where I say that the mind often gaslights the body, because it's always like, no, it's all okay. And the body's like, But that implicit memory doesn't even have words to it. It's held, it's felt, and that pops out. And that's a reminder. It's not that you're not over it. You are over it. But our bodies are really, and our sympathetic nervous systems are magnificent in how they hold on, and they're also harmful in how they hold on to that which harmed us, because even if the thing is no longer harmful, it still signals us in the same way. And all we can do is receive ourselves with gentleness. I often tell clients, talk to yourself like your kid, like, hey, it's okay. Like, this is gone. This is done. But I get why you're scared. And we can, instead of saying, what is wrong with you? Why aren't you over him? We can have a very different conversation with that sort of vulnerable part of ourselves.
Yeah. Okay. We need to take one more break. When we get back, I want to say one more thing about this and then talk about codependency. We'll be right back.
No one told us the truth about parenthood. Why? This is the podcast everyone needed before they had kids, because now that those little ones are here, there is a lot to unpack. I'm Rachel Shepard-Ota, and I am your host for the podcast No One Told Us, where we tell the truth about parenting and let you in on all the stuff you really should have known about before having kids. I am the founder of Hey Sleepy Baby, but this podcast is so much more than sleep. We'll be diving into all the topics that you really care about and need to know while you do your best job raising those adorable, tidy humans. Our goal is to just make you feel less alone and less overwhelmed. There are so many things that no one tells us before becoming a parent, and I think that we should really pull back the curtain on becoming a first-time or second-time mom or dad to share the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll have a little education, a little fun, and a whole lot of heart that goes into each and every episode. So join me and our amazing guests each week to hear us talk about what no one told us.
Feel like you're the martyr in your family? You're not alone. Hey, this is Joanne.
And Brie.
And we're from the No Guilt Mom podcast. Brie, we talk to a lot of moms.
Yeah, we sure do.
And if you're a mom who has a to-do list that is so massive that you get overwhelmed and you shut down,
or if you fall into the habit of doing everything for everyone and don't know how to change it, we can help you become a no-guilt mom.
We're going to take you from family martyr to family model. That's role model, so that you role model the behavior that you want to see out of your kids.
You're going to go from being tired and overwhelmed to energized and guilt-free.
Every week, you'll get actionable strategies that you can implement right away from the experts that we interview and from us.
We also have a whole lot of fun, so check out the No-Guilt Mom podcast everywhere you listen to your favorite shows.
Regarding what you just said, I love all of that. And also the way I describe it, and you know, you've obviously put it somewhere much more eloquently, is that when people say that, like, how are you not over it? I say, I am over him. Like, you know, I'm very aware, like, I don't want to be with this person. I'm not in love with this person anymore. I think that my body isn't over the event. Those were two very different things. Mm-hmm. And by event, I mean like the abuse that happened, the way that we split up. It was very dramatic and traumatic. And so that's how I describe it, which sounds a lot exactly like how you described it.
I think most people are over the person. Mm-hmm. And I think we all use our language. You're saying, I'm not over the event. I mean, I would say for some of my clients would say, I'm not over the experience of this. And so that's why so many survivors have rumination, right? Because you play it out over and over again. Rumination is not necessarily a bad thing. Where rumination becomes a problem is when there's no solution. But when a person comes out of one of these relationships, to me, rumination is sort of the final off-gassing, sort of let it go, because this was not a normal, safe experience. And when things aren't normal or safe, they kind of get stuck. in our heads, because again, we're trying to solve the unfixable problem. But we regret this experience, and we regret like the disruption in attachment, the loss of safety. These are very, very primal kinds of experiences. Because somebody's not coming at you with a weapon or isn't violent, a lot of people are saying, what are you saying you weren't safe? Come on. Like, it's not like they were. And in fact, people will take offense. They'll say, I know him. He's not a dangerous guy. Mm-hmm. And they forget that the word safety, it means two things. Yes, there's physical safety, but there's also psychological safety. And we underestimate that, because when that gets, and these relationships undermine that constantly, because it's even as simple as, I don't know how to show up. I don't know how to be. Do I be cheerful with them? Do I be quiet with them? Do I be solicitous? Like, you're literally playing this game where you're thinking, how do I show up so I don't get raged at, screamed at, manipulated? So it's not authentic. Mm-hmm. It's performative and at best transactional, so you can survive. That's what I mean by a loss of psychological safety. Yeah. You don't get to be you.
Okay. Thank you for that extra bit of information. And so how does codependency play a role in all of this? Because we've talked a lot about, I've had a lot of experts on here talking about codependency specifically.
Codependency is a tricky model when we're talking about narcissistic relationships. I mean, remember the origins of the codependency model around the 1950s. Again, just as, you know, our conversations about alcohol and substance use and addiction were kind of coming up in a different way, codependency became part of that conversation. And it really reflected the sort of harmful behaviors that a person in a relationship with a person living with an addict engages in, often getting their self-esteem from the highs and lows. Like, a sober day means that the other person, the codependent person as it was, is good. Mm-hmm. And then when the person wasn't sober or was raging or something like that, they were bad. So right. Their entire sort of self was linked to that person. There can even be, for example, a unwillingness to seek help for codependent people, that the maintenance of the dynamic becomes its own kind of living, breathing thing. And again, so much identity gets derived from that relationship, right? It is also not unusual for codependent people to also share in whatever the psychiatric or addictive profile of the other person is, also participate in substance use or share whatever other mental health problems, like two people with personality issues getting into a relationship. It's a tricky framework for people experiencing narcissistic relationships, because clinically, I have to say, we're so unwilling to call these relationships what they are. We're so tiptoeing on eggshells. Let's not say anything that's going to hurt the manipulative person's feelings. Mm-hmm. And that's the therapist talking. I'm like, why don't you just call this what it is? It's unacceptable. And I understand they have a backstory and they had this, and I get all that. But at the surface of it, the top of this damn iceberg is unacceptable. And so we have not been willing to do that in toxic relationships. And what happens is, a significant proportion of survivors of these so-called narcissistic relationships, I would say 60 to 70%, once they're given very clear education on what this relationship is about, they're like, are you kidding me? And remember, this is coming up in a different way. I've been doing this pre-internet, let me put it that way, where there wasn't 1,000 TikTok people, where people yammering on, my boyfriend cheated, he's a narcissist, 5 reasons this, 4 reasons that. You actually, there was no way to get this information before. So unless you got lucky and had a therapist who could point it out, these were people who were bumping into walls, who were being told they were unforgiving, who were being told that relationships are compromised. And then when they got the playbook, we're like, no, which very few of us still do, and say, this is a personality. And more above all else, this is not going to change. This is this relationship. Some people would leave my practice, come back 10 years later, 10 years, and say, okay, I wish I'd taken a bet with them. They'll say, yep, not one thing changed. And, you know, I feel so sad for them, but that was their process. They had to figure it out that way. So I don't consider it codependency when psychoeducation is going to turn the ship around. That defies everything we know about codependency, which is a very, very entrenched sort of a pattern. And I would argue codependency also has its roots in a trauma response. So since that's many people in adult narcissistic relationships don't have a childhood past, what they do, though, is a steady diet of nonsensical Disney films that tell them, rom-coms that tell them what relationships are look like, that who choose partners on the basis of a checklist, all of that. That's how people end up in these relationships. But when they're educated and they're told about it, they don't stick around. Some do. And some would argue that trauma bonding has some shared variance with codependency, but they are distinct constructs.
I sort of chuckled to myself when you said the thing about, you know, 10 years later, someone comes to your practice and say, like, this person didn't change. In my relationship, we were together for 10 years before we even got married. And I thought that getting married would change him and like, okay, he's going to settle down. And to be fair, we both kind of calmed down a little bit. And I think that just came with, you know, we turned 30, we weren't partying quite as much anymore. And after we split, it was, you know, because I found out about an affair, I was at a grief group and I was telling my story. And there was a woman who, you know, she was a solid, maybe like 15 or so years, my senior. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was crying and saying, I really thought that getting married, things would change. And I really wanted to have children with him. Mm-hmm. And here I am, you know, like feeling sorry for myself. And she came up to me afterwards and she said, I want you to know that I have a story very similar to yours. And I was married to my husband for 20 mm. years. And we have 3 children together and I'm here because he did not change.
Yep.
I really think that, you know, he wouldn't have changed. And if you would have had children with him. So I will never forget her mm-hmm, because, mm-hmm. and she was just fresh from hers too. Yeah. And I had that overwhelming feeling of I could be her in 20 yeah. years if I had stayed, or, you know, the circumstances were different and we would have stayed and had children together. So I appreciate you saying that, and to that anonymous woman, wherever she is. Thank yeah. you so much for this. Everyone, Dr. Romani's book is It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People. So I love a book. I love a self-help book with a solution, not just talking about the problem.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I've already written the one that's descriptive. So this is the, you know, the work isn't easy though, right? It really is about yeah. seeing it clearly and then really diving into figuring out who you are separate from this person. These relationships sort of overtake us, envelop us, you know? And so yeah. it's almost like shaking off the wreckage and saying, who am I separate from this? And once you can figure that out, even if you can't get out of the relationship, and some people can't, you can at least recognize there is a you separate from them.
So is there anything that you want to say? I know we covered a lot. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that mm-hmm. you want to say that you want to circle back to underscore before we close up in order for you to feel complete?
Yeah. I mean, I'm so glad. I almost want to go back to where we began, which is this idea of, you know, we talk so much about toxic relationships, narcissistic relationships, trauma bonded relationships, call it what you will. We often don't talk about what's healthy. And I think that that's another place people are stuck. Vast majority of folks I've worked with said, I actually don't know. No one ever told me. I was like, I was on a clock. Somebody said, okay, he has a job. I suppose that makes him marriable. He did buy me flowers once. People's bars are set really low in terms of what qualifies as healthy. And I think that what that makes it more difficult to figure out what is unhealthy. And if you grew up with manipulation and other tactics like that as a child, you don't even know. You don't even know what constitutes somebody showing up as a decent human being. And some people will even say, if they're trauma bonded in relationships from childhood, will say, I kind of felt bored with the kind of steady as she goes, you know, there were no big volatile fights and, mm-hmm. and it was just sort of steady, steady, steady. And I was just speaking with someone very recently and she said, you know, I came out of a narcissistic relationship of 25 years, kids, marriage, the whole thing, and now started dating again and met a lovely, lovely, lovely guy. And she said, I have to talk myself down when I feel bored mm-hmm. because it God is bless. Boring. And she said, and it's wonderful. Right. And so it's like weather that never changes. It's always a perfect sunny 78 degrees. But she said, I realize now, had I not had that 25 years of hell, had I met this man younger, I would have left him. And so in some ways, there's a real beauty in healing from any form of adversity, because people who can really hold on to that and recognize that they can write an act two, if you will, but you got to remember act one to carry the story. And so that's a big part of it. So I just want anyone going through these relationships to know healing is very, very possible. It takes a minute, but it's not, I mean, I've seen it happen more often than not. So I just really want to infuse people with a sense of hope as they mm-hmm. leave this episode.
I appreciate that. And I think I can attest to that as someone who's continues to heal from the multi-layers that are on it, and you get mm-hmm. into new relationships and sobriety, and it can all play a part in the healing. So I appreciate you and your work so much. We will put a link to the show notes for the book and your right. social media. Is there anywhere specific around the book that you want people to go? Anything they should know?
Yeah, just I would say go to drromini.com, my website. Definitely order the book, order it anywhere you want. And then we have all kinds of stuff. There's reading guides. We'll have, you know, other sorts of additional giveaways, all of that. Just go to our website, follow us on social media. You know, it's a big push to sell it, but then we're going to keep talking about it as people get to read it and really reflect on how it applies to their lives.
Thank you for doing that for my listeners, for everyone who will get so much out of this book. Listeners, thank you so much for your time. I know how precious it is, and I appreciate that you choose to spend it with me and my guests. And remember, it's our life's journey to make ourselves better humans and our life's responsibility to make the world a better place. Bye for now. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. I would be so incredibly grateful if you haven't done so already, if you could leave a review of this podcast on Apple Podcasts. Super easy if you already listen to your shows over there. But if you don't, or maybe you have the app on your phone, but you listen to the show on a different app, if you could leave a review for this show, it matters so much. I wish I could express how much it matters. I also wish that it didn't matter so much, but alas, it does. So if you haven't already, please go review and rate the show. It would mean so much to me. And thank you so much. I hope you have an amazing day.
If you're a parent, I invite you to join us at the Mindful Mama podcast, where it's all about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. With sometimes hilarious and always thought-provoking experts and friends, at Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have. And when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm Hunter Clark Fields, and I can't wait to see you there. Listen in to the Mindful Mama podcast.